Lights.
Camera.
Philosophy.
It's the 2019 Dionysus Awards.
For the most philosophically compelling movies of the year.
And the categories are...
The most existentialist cowboy movie.
I, too, have been known to violate the statutes of man, and not a few of the laws of the Almighty.
You ain't no outlaw, and we don't drink with tin horns.
For the least superficial superhero movie.
Hey, guys.
Wanda?
It's Gwen, actually. I'm from another dimension. I mean, another dimension.
The most satisfying attempt to rectify an entire industry's neglect of African-American points of view.
Didn't life start right here on this continent? So ain't all people your people?
I am not king of all people. I am king of Wakanda.
Join us as we celebrate the movies that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
It's the sixth, mostly annual, Dionysus Awards.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, it's our sixth annual Dionysus Awards show.
The Dionysus Awards are presented to the most philosophically interesting movies of the past year.
We'll talk to philosophers, critics, and listeners like you to find out what movies challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways. We'll be discussing superhero movies, the Coen brothers, and the year in black cinema.
Speaking of black cinema, Josh, did you know that more Hollywood movies were directed by black filmmakers last year than at any time in movie history? And a lot of those films depicted a scene that's all too familiar in contemporary life, police shooting unarmed black men.
And that's why we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to examine the ways directors have been representing police brutality on the big screen. She files this report.
Reggie Ugwu is a pop culture reporter for the New York Times. He remembers watching film after film last year where black protagonists witnessed police brutality. Films like
Hate U Give
and Monsters and Men, also
Black Klansmen
and
Blindspotting,
all in one year.
Within a few months of each other.
These films were all released around 4 years after Eric Garner died when a New York cop put him in a chokehold. Before he went limp, Garner whispered the words, "I can't breathe." The next month, Michael Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri.
Police shot this boy outside my apartment.
The off-screen horrors of police brutality and racial injustice are still unfolding in real time. So Reggie watched these movies in rapid-fire succession, examining them like historical documents. He wrote a New York Times piece called The Unreality of Racial Justice Cinema about whether these films can ever be truthful.
You can look at them as our first crack at very recent history. You know, what is the story that we're telling ourselves of what it's like to be black and alive in this country right now?
Reggie was most fascinated by the way the movies ended. It just didn't feel real. Spoiler alert, they either end with protagonists who become empowered after witnessing police brutality or with protagonists getting vengeance in unlikely scenarios. One movie that shows that superhero transformation is The Hate U Give. It's about a teenager named Star who witnesses her childhood friend shot and killed by a cop during a traffic stop.
Officer needs help. Shots fired. One suspect down. The other in custody. Requesting an ambulance.
What did you do? What did you do?
Be quiet, ma'am.
Throughout the movie, Star struggles to decide whether to testify against the cop. In the end, she does. The trauma of witnessing her friend die seems to empower her. She speaks up in front of a crowd during a protest, stands up to her racist friends, and confronts her boyfriend who feigns colorblindness.
Star, I just told you I don't see color. I see people for who they are the exact same way I see you.
If you don't see my blackness, you don't see me.
Reggie says it's like a superhero movie, but instead of being bitten by a bug like Spider-Man, Star is exposed to state violence and police brutality. He says this approach to cinematic endings is upbeat, but it feels like a fantasy.
The film sort of uses this tragedy as a catalytic event that leads to her transformation.
Other films rely on what Reggie calls the revenge fantasy option. Blindspotting is an example. That film is about a guy named Colin who's trying to finish up the last 3 days of probation without getting in trouble. But his best friend keeps getting in the way by starting fights and buying guns in the back of cars.
Why are there 6 guns in your car, Dad?
Oh, Colin, man, I like yours.
Right here, this is not mine. Also, stop pointing at me.
They're not loaded, bro.
Those are for sure loaded.
Okay. Okay.
Early in the film, Colin sees a police officer shoot and kill a man. And another spoiler alert. The movie ends when Colin points a gun at the cop. He then unleashes a biting freestyle rap on the sobbing police officer.
You might think you know what's happening, but you don't feel it like we do. To feel it, it has to be you. How come every time you come around, you monsters got me feeling like a monster in my own town?
Before he takes off, Colin says to the cop,
"The difference between me and you, I ain't no killer."
Marcello.
Reggie says we're so saturated with constant images of black men being killed that it's almost atmospheric, like background noise. We're used to cops who don't get prosecuted, so endings like these are attempts at closure, a chance for the audience to see evil in the face and get their revenge. But that's not how it usually plays out in real life.
I can imagine if you're trying to make a film and you're trying to sell tickets and you're asking people to go along with you on this journey, you know, maybe you don't want to have as an ending, the thing that they've already seen at home, and that they've already watched with dread. Maybe you want to give them something else.
But if these films are intended to be historical documents, the truth is important. Black Klansman is a movie with many endings. One of them shows footage of the deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Reggie Ugwu writes about this in his New York Times piece. The footage is not uplifting and it's not satisfying. It may not feel like an ending, but the story of racial injustice in America doesn't have an ending yet. As Reggie describes it, it's a vision of a society as likely to eat itself as to heal. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly Jim McDeed.
Thanks for that report, Holly. We're going to talk more about Black Klansman and other African-American-themed movies later in the show, but one Black-centered film that didn't come up in Holly's report was actually one of the biggest movies of the year, Black Panther.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Black Panther was one of the films of 2018, a great African-American movie, a great superhero movie, and just a great movie.
Yeah, I agree. It was a stellar year for superhero movies in general, but I got two questions about this genre. First of all, is it art? And second, why should philosophers care about superhero movies?
Maybe those two questions are intertwined. I mean, I think one of the ways in which something could qualify for art, whatever that means, could be that they're philosophically rich. They're not just, of course, they're entertaining. Big explosions and excitement and thrills. But I think in some cases, they're also more ambitious. They want to get us thinking about things.
Okay, Liz, three of them are nominated for Academy Award. Black Panther, The Incredibles 2, and Into the Spider-Verse. Now, okay, I want you to tell me, are these art? Are these philosophically ambitious movies?
Yeah, I think they're all terrific. And one thing they all have in common is they raise questions about identity. So if you think about, obviously, Black Panther raises the issue of race, I mean, among many other issues that the movie raises. Spider-Man, I don't want to give too much away, but this is a fascinating reboot where the Spider-Man of the movie has an African-American father and a Puerto Rican mother.
Where's my laptop?
Hey, if you want me to drive you, we got to go now.
No, I'll walk.
Personal chauffeur going once.
It's okay.
Miles, got to go.
In a minute.
In a minute.
In a minute.
there's gender issues. Think about The Incredibles is, you know, kind of foregrounds questions of gender roles.
That's true. That's true.
In general, superhero movies kind of are interested in identity because everyone has a secret identity. And then Incredibles, I mean, Incredibles isn't necessarily a totally fully realized movie, but I love what it's doing with this question because it has this kind of debate between whether you are a superhero regardless of whether you're actually doing super things or whether, in fact, it's your actions that make you the superhero.
Where's Mom?
She's up and out. She's at her new job doing hero work.
But I thought superheroes were still illegal.
They are, for now.
So Mom is getting paid to break the law.
She's not breaking. She's an advocate for superheroes. It's a new job.
You have characters in Incredibles 2 who think that the world is a worse place for the existence of superheroes, which I think is fascinating because, you know, the thought is supposed to be, so one way of thinking about it is, well, they kind of mess everything up and don't really get much done. But a more interesting way of thinking about it is they deprive us of our agency. So there's a bad guy called the Screen Slaver who, in spite of being the baddie, kind of articulates a really interesting challenge, which is, look, if you believe that there are these heroes waiting to save us, you'll just kind of relax and not really make the effort to change the world yourself.
You want superheroes to protect you and make yourselves ever more powerless in the process, while you tell yourself you're being looked after, that your interests are being served, and your rights are being upheld, so that the system can keep stealing from you, smiling at you all the while.
But there's also Black Panther. Some people found it very controversial. There's a philosopher, Chris LeBron, who calls Black Panther not the superhero movie we deserve, although he praises the role of the women and all that stuff. But I do think it had one profound thought. The profound thought, which I think is perhaps true, is that history, that the world is broken. History breaks everything it touches. Everybody who participates in history gets broken, right? And the reason Wakanda is not broken is because it stood outside of history. But then there's this fundamental dilemma that it raises for Wakanda, right? Well, you're standing apart from the world. You're standing apart from the struggle for black liberation with all these people. You got all this super technology, you got all these superpowers. Use it to ameliorate the world. But if you use it to ameliorate the world, that means you have to join history. And since history breaks everything, you'll be broken too.
Our weapons will not be used to wage war on the world. It is not our way to be judge, jury, and executioner for people who are not our own.
Not your own. But didn't life start right here on this continent? So ain't all people your people?
I am not king of all people. I am king of Wakanda.
It raises the question of what makes that people our people. In the end, the Wakanda does claim the world as its people. So I think that's a profound thing. I do think the movie kind of wimps out at the end, right? Because it says, oh, how are we going to participate in history? We're going to build some community centers, right?
Yeah, that's a little pathetic at the end, bathos. But I love that point, Ken. I think it's a really great interpretation of the film. And I think maybe it gets, you know, you were asking earlier, are these films art? And maybe this recognition of tragedy could be part of what's, you know, changed about the way in which superhero movies are getting made. There's a certain kind of grim, almost grim realism, if that doesn't seem so too strange to say in the context of superhero movie.
This is what you would have me leave the daughter for. To bring our children into this world where they become conquerors.
Yes. Our children will be leaders of a truly free world. Not just a tiny country where we have to hide everything that makes us great.
Okay, I want to talk about Into the Spider-Verse. Do you think it measures up to that standard?
I'm very tempted to put it up for a Dionysus Award. I'm not sure it totally measures up. Let me tell you what's something I like and something I don't like.
Okay.
One thing I love is that it's so fresh visually, and it's, you know, it almost has the feel of reading a comic book.
Yeah.
And I love it that it's going into parallel universes. That's completely fascinating. I love it that it kind of reboots with a Spider-Man who's a kid whose dad is African-American, whose mother's Puerto Rican, and so it was able to get issues of racial identity into the mix. The only thing I'm a little disappointed by is that if there's one thing worse than a preachy movie, it's a preachy movie that doesn't make sense. And you know, this movie ends with some tagline about how we can all be superheroes. But yeah, we're not all bitten by a radioactive spider. So yeah. How is this supposed to work out exactly?
Well, I mean, the Superman story is sort of like this, too. Because why is Superman Superman? Because he was cast out into the universe to wander about and found a planet and landed on a planet with a yellow sun, which interacted with his Kryptonian biochemistry somehow. That never explains that. To thrust upon him superpowers, which he did not ask for. Well, the radioactive spider, he could bite any of us. And that's kind of the point of the movie. Anybody could be a superhero because a life could thrust upon you circumstances that give you these unique opportunities. And the superhero in you, the true superhero in you, is the person who doesn't run from such opportunities but says embracing them. And Black Panther, kind of these are ordinary human beings, but they have all this cool technology, but they're othered because they're not part of history, right? Okay, so we got three movies that I think are plausible candidates for a Dionysus Awards: Black Panther, Into the Spider-Verse, and Incredibles 2. But, you know, frankly, I really can't decide. So what do you think?
Listen, you have convinced me that Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is worthy of some consideration. I think I would give it a runner-up award. But the 2019 Dionysus Award for the least superficial superhero movie goes to Black Panther.
Look at this. A handheld sonic cannon powerful enough to stop a tank. And traceable by metal detectors. And we got thousands of them. The world's gonna find out exactly who we are.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our sixth annual Dionysus Award show. We're honoring the most philosophically compelling movies of 2018.
Coming up, we'll be taking listener nominations. And Ken and I will be announcing winners in the categories of Best Thought Experiment About the Possibility of Racial Justice and Most Profound Existentialist Cowboy Movie.
More Dionysus winners plus nominations from the floor when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back. This is Philosophy Talk. It's our annual Dionysus Award show for the most thought-provoking films of 2018. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. What movies did you see last year that challenged your assumptions and made you think about things in new ways? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or tweet us. Our handle is @PhilTalkRadio.
We're joined now by Carla Oler. She's a professor in the Department of Art and Art History at Stanford University, where she teaches film and media studies. Carla, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you've got a movie that you loved from 2018 that you'd like to nominate for a Dionysus Award. Which one is it?
It's Black Klansman, directed by Spike Lee.
Oh, great film. That's a great film. Controversial film.
Yes.
Why do you think this is not just a good movie, but a philosophically interesting movie?
I think it's philosophically interesting because it is blatantly fictional in its story world. And the fictionality has to do with a character played by John David Washington, who simply wants to become a police officer. And it's as if all the questions of race in America and the idea that we don't live up to the aspiration that everyone be equal under the law falls away for him so that he never has an identity crisis himself about his work.
So this is obviously a young African-American man who wants to become a police officer.
In the 70s.
In the 1970s,
yes.
Where it's not at all obvious.
Right.
But that's interesting because there's a conversation that he has with Patrice, a young woman that he meets, where she says to him, she doesn't know he's a cop.
Right.
But she's talking in general about cops and saying, you know, it would be really tough for an African-American to be a cop because of what Du Bois says about double consciousness. You would be torn apart.
We fight for what black people really need, black liberation.
Right. So can't you do that from the inside?
No, you can't. The white man won't give up his position in power without a struggle. What did Du Bois say about double consciousness, two-ness, being an American and a Negro? Two warring ideals inside one dark body?
So what you're saying, Carla, I take it, is surprisingly, he's not torn apart by a kind of double consciousness. He's just able to be a cop and be African-American, and there's no tension between those two things.
Yes. John David Washington gives a performance of insouciance, I would say, where he is not terribly expressive, but neither is he evacuated. And it's really almost Buster Keaton-esque in the way he plays this role. And that enables him to be this kind of contrast with Patrice, who actually has very strong political views and a very clear sense of the way racial discrimination works. And so the way the two of them work together raises this question about what it would look like if everyone were equal under the law versus the reality that we don't live up to that aspiration.
The situation in this movie is complicated, right? His first assignment as an undercover cop is to infiltrate the Black Student Union, a radical group that's inviting Kwame Ture to campus. He goes to this talk in which Kwame Ture is giving a kind of nationalist speech, and he falls in love with the president of the Black Student Union, who's very radicalized, and they have these searing conversations about this. And also on the police force are clearly racist cops that confronts Patrice, the president of the Black Student Union. So the situation, I don't know about him and his internality, but the situation raises the question, searingly, what is a black man in those times at that place doing being a cop?
Are you a pig?
Excuse me?
Are you a pig?
You mean a cop?
Are you a cop?
No. I'm in construction, but more importantly, I'm a black man. He wants to get to know a strong, intelligent, beautiful sister. The very one I'm looking at right now.
Boots Riley criticizes Spike Lee for making this easy fiction that makes it possible to see the cops as an ally in the struggle for racial justice, when in that time, in reality, Boots Riley seems to say, no, that's not possible.
That's absolutely correct. Boots Riley criticizes the film for fabricating history in order to make a black cop and his counterparts look like allies in the fight against racism. That's actually a direct quote from Boots Riley's critique. And my question is, does the film, as Riley argues, make unreality appear to be real? And what I would argue is the film is blatantly unrealistic, and it actually flaunts its unreality.
It isn't, but there are these moments. One of my favorite moments is Isaiah Whitlock Jr., who plays Clay Davis on The Wire, and was famous for a word I can't say on the radio, but a very lengthened swear word. And Spike Lee has him come on BlacKkKlansman and say the same famous catchphrase. I mean, if that's not a blatant indication that this film is fiction, I don't know what is.
Yes, Spike Lee is, in my view, one of the great living American filmmakers who has a deep knowledge of cinema. And he is tapping into the aspirational tradition of American cinema, an aspirational tradition that perhaps speaks to World War II combat films that, when American armed forces were segregated, made them appear as if they were all fighting side by side. And I realize that that's, on the one hand, a lie, but on the other hand, I also feel that there's an aspirational quality to it. And I feel that BlacKkKlansman has that aspirational quality, even as it undercuts it as an untruth, as fiction, by including that documentary footage at the end.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I do think there's an aspirational thing. There's an aspiration to represent a possibility, right? And the possibility is that diverse people, because, you know, the Jewish cop, the black cop, most of the white cops in the end, right, gang up to out the racist cop. The black militant student cooperates with them to out the racist cop, and they arrest him in this bar and all this sort of stuff. That's one of the scenes that Boots Riley really objects to. You know,
I wish the two of you been blowing up instead of good white folks. Get it?
Oh,
I do get it. Do you get it, Patrice?
Yeah, I totally and completely get it.
Jimmy, did you get it?
Oh, yes, I got it.
Flip, did you get it?
Oh, yeah, I got it.
Chief, do you get it?
Oh, I really, really get it. You're under arrest.
What?
Not just because it's not realistic, it's not morally honest. Right, that's what I think he thinks.
And here is where I would agree but go a step further, which is that that scene is perhaps the most blatantly unrealistic scene in the film. As we all know, it's very likely that police forces cover up their brutalizations of minority populations. But I feel that the fictionality of that particular scene makes itself felt in sometimes in very subtle ways, because the music playing in that scene is Emerson, Lake and Palmer's "Oh, What a Lucky Man He Was." And that lucky man is ambiguous. It could refer to Ron Stallworth and Patrice, for whom in the fictionalized story world, violence is evaded, but it could also refer to the man and, oh, what a lucky man, the white man he was, and this aspiration that a society where some are luckier than others, that the aspiration is that that would not be the case much longer.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual Dionysus Award show. We're talking to Carla Oler from Stanford University about Spike Lee's Black Klansman. I don't know if you've seen Sorry to Bother You. It's a critique of the logic of capitalism, right? And it's got a complicated view about race and class. It's mostly about class and about his authenticity as a black man, because he gets a class privilege that's at odds with his kind of lack of race privilege. And capitalism just does that to you. It takes a people and divide them. It privileges some. And then at the end of it, it's just this dark reality.
I'm Cassius Green, calling on behalf of StopAMudHoleInYourAss.com. Sorry to bother you, bro.
That part of the movie I thought was very strong, but I think it's kind of funny that Boots Riley is criticizing Spike Lee for a lack of realism in Black Klansman, when his own movie, Sorry to Bother You, it's highly stylized.
Not only and super.
And even at the kind of the allegorical level, yeah, it's a little simplistic.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that's a, it's a curious
tension.
But would you
deny that's a powerful movie?
I think it's a really interesting and bold movie. And it has, in a great way, a kind of flavor of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. But I also think it's a slightly flawed movie. I don't think it's...
What's the main flaw, you would
to
say?
To me, the main flaw is at the kind of conceptual level. You know, needs more Foucault. You've got a world that, in which things are going terribly, especially for the African-American population, but even for the broader population.
Yeah, because it's kind of a Marxist thing. Because
exactly.
Class antagonisms are deeper than racial antagonisms.
That's exactly right in the case of this movie. The problem with it, as I see it, is that maybe this is just exigencies of Hollywood, but basically there's one villain.
Worry-free CEO Steve Lift was interviewed on Oprah today.
No, conclusively no. Our workers do not sign contracts under threats of physical violence. So therefore, the comparison to slavery is just ludicrous and offensive. We're transforming life itself. We're saving the economy. I mean, we're saving lives.
There's one more movie I do want to get into, because it's, again, controversial and it's black theme, but it's not made by a black creative voice. Green Book, I think Green Book, directed by Peter Farrelly, who's just a white guy, is a very fine movie about race and racial identification and racial recognition, but it's arisen all this controversy, right? Because the main characters, there's a black musician and this Italian guy who he hires to drive him on a concert tour through the South in 1962, right, before the public accommodations bill was passed. So that I remember going to the South when I was a young kid, and my parents had this Green Book. I remember we stopped once to use the restroom. My dad, who's an Army drill sergeant, stopped at this gas station and said, "May we use the restroom, boy, sir?" To this, like, gas station attendant. They don't have those anymore, but in those days, they had gas station attendant. And he says, "Around the back, boy." He calls my dad a boy, right? My dad's a big, strong guy. And we walk around past the restroom that says ladies and then past the one that says gentlemen. And in the back is this really gross place that says colored, right? And I'm like 7 years old or something. And I'm like, can I use that restroom? I had never seen anything so gross. And so here's this world-class musician, voluntarily doing a tour in the South, accompanied by this racist Italian driver.
We'll be attending many events before and after the concerts, interacting with some of the wealthiest and most highly educated people in the country. It is my feeling that your diction, however charming it may be in the tri-state area, could use some finessing.
You mean diction like in what way?
Like in the only way the word is ever used?
I've seen criticisms that it's a white savior movie. I don't see it that way at all. I mean, it seems to me that only one person is saving one person, and that's, you know, Don Shirley is saving Tony Vallelonga from his racism.
I think they're saving each other because Don Shirley is so disconnected. There's this wonderful scene in that movie, which I think a lot of people will find objectionable, but I think it's a powerful scene in which Don Shirley sort of talks about his own felt inauthenticity. He's not black enough for black people, right? He's not a white person. Where does he belong? Who is he? And the Tony character is, I know who I am.
You don't know your own people. You, Mr. Big Shot, doing concerts for rich people.
So if I'm not black enough, and if I'm not white enough, then tell me, Tony, what am I?
But here's the question I have for you. It's just a more general philosophical question. Can a white person write black subjectivity? Can a black person write white subjectivity? We seem to have gotten ourselves in a position where we don't believe I can write anybody's subjectivity as an author, as a director, as a filmmaker, except a subjectivity like my own.
I think that in terms of cinema, Spike Lee's position is that we saw a black president before we saw a black CEO of a major entertainment corporation. And I think it's very important to live in a society where you have the resources and the ability to tell your own story. And when a society doesn't make those resources available for everyone to tell their own story, then it becomes difficult to have this greater aspiration, which is that everyone has the imaginative capability to put themselves in another person's shoes, even if those shoes are quite different. And so, again, it's a complicated question. It relies on a kind of idealism.
I agree. And I think, look, the argument mostly here is one shouldn't talk about other people's experiences. There's something morally wrong about that. I think one shouldn't not talk about other people's experiences. There's something, you know, our task as human beings is to imagine our way into other ways of life and other experiences and other backgrounds.
I absolutely agree. We have to do that with the recognition that doing that is to some extent always going to be impossible. And so when we do it, we also have to do it not just with a degree of responsibility, but with a degree of humility mm-hmm. and of recognition that we can be wrong. And that's what I was trying to say when I was saying that we're doing it in an imperfect society. So to do so is both necessary, but also very fraught. And I think that Black Klansman brings together these two qualities. One is the aspiration of equal justice for all, and the other is the reality of the world in which we have that aspiration, but we haven't quite achieved it, and showing how that has implications than in the story world among these three different characters, namely Patrice, Ron Stallworth, and also Flip Zimmerman, where Patrice and Flip are both having serious identity crises at various points in the film. But Ron Stallworth doesn't really have an identity crisis about his inspiration to be a police officer because he's operating on that idea that the law is there to protect all citizens equally, and it's as if he doesn't really see the actual historical circumstances in which he's working.
Okay, so therefore, the Dionysus Award for the best thought experiment in the possibility of racial justice goes to
Black Klansman.
Mr. Duke, favor to ask? Nobody's going to believe me when I tell them that I was your personal bodyguard today.
Care to take a Polaroid with me?
Carla, thank you so much for recommending Black Klansman, for having this stimulating conversation with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're taking a philosophical look at the movies of 2018 for our 6th annual Dionysus Award.
In our next segment, we'll take nominations from our listeners and from an old friend of the show. He'll be nominating the latest offering from the ever-thoughtful Coen brothers.
Suggestions from the floor and so much more when Philosophy Talk continues. It's the 6th annual Dionysus Awards. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're talking about the most philosophically compelling movies of 2018.
We're joined now by an old friend of the show, Troy Jalamoy. He's a professor of philosophy at Chico State University. He's an award-winning poet, and he's a huge fan of some very philosophical filmmakers, the Coen brothers. Troy, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Good to be here.
So, Troy, you convinced us to watch the Coen brothers' new movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and it seems like you think it's philosophical. So tell us why that is.
I certainly think it's very philosophical. It's a unique film, unique for the Coen brothers and unique generally in that it's not a single narrative from beginning to end. It's an anthology film, 6 distinct stories. Each of the stories has a very different feel from the rest. There aren't any characters that recur in different stories. They're all completely independent that way. And even in terms of musically, visually, and so on, they're all very different from each other. Thematically, they're all in some way about death, which makes sense because the Western as a genre has always been about death.
Yeah, I think of this movie as death stalks you in many ways. Right? It's sort of like Tolstoy, the death of Ivan Ilyich. Ivan Ilyich is spending his whole life trying to avoid this thing, and then at the end of it, you read about the looming it, which was always there around the corner. And these vignettes always have that same feel.
I think that's right. I think the clearest sense of that we get in this particular film is in the second segment, the one with James Franco, where he plays a cowboy who robs a bank. And of course, it's inevitable that he's going to be hanged. He gets hanged essentially twice in the film, the short film. Early on, he manages to escape through a series of ludicrous chants and so on. But before too long, one thing after another happens, and he ends up being up there again at the gallows and getting hanged.
First time.
There's something lovely about that particular episode because, I mean, obviously it's about death, and there's this set of films as a whole is a little bit bleak, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
But a little bit?
But the way in which they've handled the story, the way in which they tell the story, there's a kind of aesthetics to this that it offsets the bleakness. So in the case of that story about the bank robbery, you have a character who's about to get hanged for a crime he did do and gets spared, and then goes on to get hanged for a crime he didn't do. And that's a beautiful little symmetry. And in the very same vignette, you have a guy who's shot through the neck with an arrow and pulls it out and he's fine, and a second later gets shot in exactly the same spot and dies. So there's this kind of war in the movie between these bleak forces of death and destruction and demoralization. And you've got this gallows humor, this comedy, and the final line when he's looking at a pretty girl in the yes. in the crowd and saying, there's a pretty girl.
Luck is such a deep part of the Coen's worldview, the idea that things don't really happen for reasons and don't make sense. The world is unintelligible, and we try to make sense of it, and we just can't. Mm. We always fail.
And it's also present right in the segment called The Gal Who Got Rattled.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one.
The young woman traveling on the Oregon Trail, yeah. And she's talking about her rather bossy brother.
Bossy and inept.
Bossy and inept brother, who was always certain about everything. And he always had an idiom ready to hand to explain everything.
He would upbraid me for being wishy-washy. I never had his certainties. I suppose it is a defect.
I don't think it's a defect at all. I don't know. Uncertainty. That is appropriate for matters of this world. Only regarding the next, we vouchsafe certainty.
That speech that you're talking about, but also in the final, whole final vignette, I think they're giving the viewers instructions as to this is what I want you to go back. Like, you may not have noticed these themes, But A, I gave you a hit in the middle. And when we get to the end, I'm laying it on you. Go back and watch this movie and make sure you pick up on these themes.
I completely agree with that. And so in this final segment, again, the mortal remains with the five characters in the stagecoach and so on. The character that ends up essentially speaking for them and who is in many ways like them is a very evil character. Mm. He is essentially death himself.
Right.
So by putting these words into the mouth of a character that, of course, no one would want to identify with, I think they're distancing from that.
Right. But even there, I mean, this is a very bleak fictional universe. I don't think this is the actual universe of the Coen brothers. You know, this is a, I mean, we've talked about death. Obviously, death is an important motif. But there's also isolation. Even when you're not dead, in the world of this movie, you're probably not very happy. You're going to be isolated. These people very rarely have any significant human connections. This is not the world that the Coen brothers are actually living.
Wait a minute. There's another line that I thought this was one of the more profound moves in The Mortal Remains. Because I think it also says something about the way stories work. The way watching works, because there are these two partners in the right. death business, right? And the one...
The bounty hunters.
The two bounty hunters.
I like to say that we're reapers, harvesters of souls. We help people who have been adjudged to be ripe.
One of the reapers says, well, my job is to tell them stories.
They're so easily taken when they're distracted, people are. So I'm the distractor with a little story, little conversation, a song, a sparkle. And Clarence does the thumping while that attention is on me.
He's very good, this one. You should see him.
No, he's good.
I can't thump.
They tell us in the mouth of the Grim Reaper one of the functions of storytelling.
Well, so that's a really, I find that a really interesting question in this movie, because you actually see different possibilities for that, to the answers to that question. What is the function of storytelling? Because you have, you know, a pretty negative theory that storytelling is just a distraction, a bad thing. And then you have a kind of neutral one. Well, storytelling is entertainment. I mean, think about that traveling showman who has an orator who reads these beautiful speeches, and it's just to make money. But then, you know, on the other side, well, storytelling could be something kind of consolation. Storytelling could be a vehicle for people to reflect on their lives. So, yes, death is one important theme in Ballad of Buster Scruggs. But isolation is another. And I think we have to take seriously the idea that these stories might be, among other things, ways of bringing us together.
Yeah, isolation, the isolation of the Western hero is such a hallmark of the genre. So it's no surprise that the Coen brothers would be drawn to this genre. They're such aesthetic directors in terms of visual beauty, and the Western affords such wonderful opportunities for beauty. The beauty in this film, and Josh, you brought this up earlier, and you mentioned the bit about James Franco in the second segment, the bank robber again, about to be hanged, suddenly noticing this pretty girl in the crowd. And apparently, as far as we can tell, wholeheartedly noticing her, you know, just forgetting for the moment that he's going to die or not caring. It's just suddenly he's fully in that moment, which is what, you know, Zen people and so on are always telling us we're supposed to be, is fully in the moment. Mm-hmm. And it really struck me on the second viewing, because it was one of the very few moments in the film where anyone seems to have any kind of aesthetic experience. They are wandering around these incredibly gorgeous landscapes and never stopping to notice the beauty of them at all. Whereas we're watching.
The prospector played by Tom Waits in the fourth vignette, All Gold Canyon. I love that story.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Okay, he doesn't quite have an aesthetic experience, but he has this kind of epiphany type of experience.
Hello, Mr. Pocket. Hello, Mr. Pocket.
I'm thinking of that lovely vignette that has the traveling showman with his orator. And the orator recites every night these poems and speeches. And, he's done it a lot, and it's kind of rote, but there's one night when he's suddenly feeling it. He's been through something, and all of a sudden, Shakespeare's Sonnet 29, he's feeling it.
When in disgrace, with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state.
I feel like that's another possibility they're presenting for us, that these works of art are vehicles for us to feel our feelings through. Maybe we can't do anything about death, but maybe we need to feel the feelings that we have about death in a way that we don't necessarily always.
I think that's very good. And I would say in the final segment, again, The Mortal Remains, when Clarence sings the song, it's a beautiful moment. It takes you entirely, almost out of the film in a sense, out of the narrative that's going on. It's simply a beautiful song. We stop to enjoy it. I found that moment personally
and
very
moving. Englishman is moved.
He cries. Yeah. This death incarnate is
death
crying.
Cries.
He has a sentimental side.
So the votes are in. And the winner for the 2019 Most Profound Existentialist Cowboy Movie is...
The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Get six pretty maidens to carry my coffin, and six pretty maidens to bear up my pall, and give to each of them bunches of roses, that they may not smell me as they go along.
Troy, thank you so much again for getting us to watch this amazing movie and for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk's 6th Annual Dionysus Awards for the most philosophically compelling movies of 2018.
And it's time for a nomination from the floor. Pradeep in Ojai, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you got a movie you want to recommend for a Dionysus Award?
Yes, I think The Children Act, directed by Richard Eyre, I believe it is, with Emma Thompson in the lead, and screenplay by Ian McEwan, based on his novel of the same name. I think it really cuts to the heart of the relationship between ethics and the law, and the ways in which our best motivated laws can run into situations because experience outruns anything we can say about the world. And it brings into focus the inhumanity that's possible with certain best intentions.
Tell me more about the story so that I can see how these questions arise in the context.
I mean,
the
basic plot question is whether it's okay for the state to intervene to force a 16-year-old boy to get a blood transfusion, even though he's a Jehovah's Witness. He's a Jehovah's Witness. He doesn't want to get a blood transfusion. He may need one. Emma Thompson is the high court judge who's called upon to decide perhaps for him. And so there are questions about paternalism. There are questions about multiculturalism, how much respect is owed by the state in cases where somebody's life may be lost.
Some people think you've been unduly influenced by your parents and the elders. Others think that you're awfully clever and we should just let you get on with it. Should we? Let you do yourself in? Somehow I've got to decide.
I think it's my choice.
I'm afraid the law doesn't agree.
The law is an ass.
The movie begins with a case of conjoined twins, where if you separate them, one will die. If you don't separate them, both will die. And it's like a real life example of the trolley problem,
right?
Right.
And you know, some of us have the intuition that we're less culpable when we allow a bad thing to happen than when we make a bad thing happen. So I guess we shouldn't do anything and let them both die. But that's clearly a bad intuition that we have. So the movie's really amazing.
Does the movie
about,
just raise those questions? Does it take us through the agonizing reason that one would have to get? Does it settle anything, or does it just raise these questions?
What do you think, Pradeep?
Oh, I think it does. I think, you know, the case that you just mentioned that the movie starts out with then leads us on to this case, the blood transfusion case. And it really takes us through issue, you know, the young man, very motivated to not be transfused and to lose his life as a consequence because of his commitment to his community and his belief. And then her commitment, the state, she represents the state, I guess, her commitment to offering a judgment in favor that promotes the welfare of the child. He is just 3 months short of being 18 and being able to make that decision on his own. So she sees him as completely autonomous, capable of reasoning, and all the marks that we would look for someone to make his or her own decision. And yet she is moved by his intelligence and his grace. And as she says, he's a lovely, lovely boy.
The boy is 100% confident that he knows what the right thing to do is. And he has an account of this. He said, you know, God implants in us a sense of what's right and wrong. But what's interesting is, in the course of the movie, this same young man changes his mind. So it really is raising the question of where our moral sense comes from. Does it come from God? Does it come from our culture, the droning other, as you talk about,
Ken? So his religion is not presented as something merely to be tolerated, but as a deep source of reasons for him. And because you might think, oh, he's a Jehovah's Witness. That's benightedness. Why, you know, okay, the state has to tolerate it, but why should I, as the watcher, think it's anything more than a benighted attitude, right? But it sounds like I have some sympathy. I'm led to have some kind of sympathetic hearing of his religiosity.
Absolutely. And actually, it's interesting that there is an effort by the lawyer who speaks on behalf of the hospital to present it to the court as a benighted way of, you know, believing. But the lawyer who's speaking on behalf of the parents and the child actually invokes human rights, that he has a choice. He's rational. He's
wow.
And this debate in the courtroom is fascinating because it becomes almost theological, where one of the counsels is saying, well, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses only decided in 1945 that blood transfusions were not acceptable. And then there's a very nice counterargument. Yes, but, you know, that was always in the mind of God.
Yeah.
So it's doing a lot of interesting philosophical and theological work.
And it's presented with great artistry, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
It sounds like this deserves a Dionysus Award.
So, the Dionysus Award for the best philosophico-theological thought experiment of 2018 goes to...
The Children Act.
I don't care if you think you're too grand. I have a right to my choice.
Your future's out there waiting for you, Adam.
Remember, all of life and love.
So, Pradeep, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can see a list of all this year's award winners at our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you've got a Dionysus-worthy movie from 2018 that wasn't discussed on today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send your nominations to comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature them on the blog.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.